Hi, David.
Hey, Brink.
How are you doing?
All right, thank you.
Let's introduce ourselves. I'm Brink Lindsey from the Cato Institute.
I'm David Fromm. I'm with the American Enterprise Institute. I'm also editor of a new website called newmajority.com, and that glow you're seeing around me is not the pearly lights. I just don't have blinds in my home.
Okay. Let me start off with a shameless plug, which I believe the masters of Blogging Heads TV are going to be cool with. And that is over at Cato Unbound, a web magazine that I helped to edit. Our issue this month is a symposium on Bob Wright's new book, The Evolution of God. We've got a great cast of commenters talking about his essay. His essay is an excerpt from his book where he's talking about the prospects for religious toleration in a post-9/11 world. We've got Timur Karan of Duke, who's an expert on how Islam has affected economic development, Richard Joyce from the University of Sydney, author of The Evolution of Morality, and Jonathan Sheehan, historian at Berkeley, author of The Enlightenment Bible. So
I just want to be clear, this book does not, in fact, endorse evolution. We just want to clarify.
Okay. So I'm urging all Blogging Heads fans to go check out Cato Unbound.
Bob Wright's book.
What do we want to talk about this morning? We want to talk about the state of the conservative mind. I think we can lead off with that.
That would be great, and then we'll take up with an idea that you launched, a term you launched, libertarian, the, to my mind, rather delusive hope that American liberalism could find scope for libertarian ideas about the economy.
Okay, let's start off with your beleaguered ideology first. I think I did a blog post a couple of weeks ago on the Cato blog about the experiences of my Cato compadre Jerry Taylor, who had inadvertently stirred up a hornet's nest when he made mention on the National Review Online blog, The Corner, where he sometimes contributes, made mention that Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity aren't really that popular outside of the conservative movement, and therefore, if they are identified as the leaders of conservatism, that's not such a great thing for conservatism. He went on to elaborate that he's not a big fan of either of those guys or of conservative talk radio in general, whereupon he got his head bitten off by his fellow cornerites, and all kinds of mayhem ensued.
Yeah,
you've been on the receiving end of stuff like that in the past, with daring to point out some of the shortcomings of Sarah Palin, as I remember.
Yeah, well, I've had my innings. I think we need to maybe separate out a couple things. One is when people feel their things aren't going well for them, they get testy, they get bad tempered. And I think there's some of that in the conservative world, and I think Jerry Taylor fell afoul of that.
Yep.
And to my mind, a lot of that requires just a bit of human sympathy to understand why people why people act badly when they're feeling down.
Yep.
Then there's an intellectual problem, which is it is true there is something wrong with the way the conservative world has responded, first to the election events of 2008, I think in a more profound way to the financial crisis. Because one of the things, the way the human mind works is we assert things that seem most relevant to be said and most salient at the moment. I'm maybe speaking too abstractly, but let me put it in a very concrete way. The modern conservative world, the Milton Friedmans, the George Stiglers, the Frank Knights, they absorb the Keynesian economic revolution of the 1930s, the intellectual revolution of the 1930s, and then move beyond it and show that that Keynes was overstated and there were things that Keynes was blind to. And anyway, Keynes is a great line by Robert Skidelsky, who wrote a terrific three-volume biography of Keynes that I recommend to everybody. He had a piece in the Financial Times this very morning in which he pointed out, well, Keynes is more a question of good judgment than good economic science, the arguments that Keynes is making. But none of those guys meant to say, look, unemployment insurance isn't awfully useful in a downturn,
right,
and that one of the reasons that we're less vulnerable to a Great Depression in the modern era than we used to be is because a larger state sector means, 1930, when you doubled the state sector, you took it from 3% to 6%, there was still 94% that was highly variable.
Yes.
When you have a state sector that's at 20 or 22%, there's just more of your economy that's relatively protected from this particular kind of economic shock. And we know all that stuff. We just didn't argue it in the 70s because it just didn't seem that relevant to the problems that we were facing back then. What seems to be going on today is that in the intensity of the argument over the Barack Obama plans, which conservatives disapprove, they're asserting some things that are much, you know, they're forgetting a lot of the things they used to know and a lot of the things that they really believe. And you're getting a very overstated, overheated version of the argument that's emotionally satisfying to conservatives, but tremendously off-putting to everybody else. I mean, it really can't be true that Paul Volcker and Warren Buffett and Tim Geithner are leading the country on the path to socialism. They have other ideas. I object to them, too. I think you do. But that's not what the really agitated, bad-tempered conservative audience wants to hear. And there's been created a huge market, or a large market.
No, especially when the trends in federal spending and the trends in government management of the economy, there's a great deal of continuity between what the Obama administration is doing and what the Bush administration was doing. It ramped up spending. It ramped up spending at a record rate. It's the one that that gave us TARP and the auto the initial auto bailout. So the Obama guys are picking up where Bush left off. There wasn't a great deal of Tea Party-style anger in the conservative base when Bush was doing it. It's only because the other gang is in power that they've discovered these small government principles. So,
well, I think, again, that's a little too hard. I think what there is, and this is, conservatives are struggling. There was a lot of this anger in the later Bush years. People didn't like it. But the conservative world is a highly organized world. There's much more party loyalty among conservatives than there is among liberals and Democrats. And so they are constrained. I think a lot of the anger that you're seeing is a kind of a reservoir of anger that people did not feel free to express.
I agree.
And suddenly has exploded. Now, some things need to be said here, just on this point. It's not all irrational. I mean, what happened with the Chrysler bondholders really was shocking, that you have people who had bonds bonds that would be valid in any court of law, where the government knew that if the bondholders went to court, they would win. And so they deployed all kinds of political pressures on the bondholders, threats, in order to deter people from making use of their legal rights in order to achieve a government conception of how the auto industry should be bailed out. By the way, a conception that in the case of Chrysler is almost certain not to work, and in the case of GM is probably not.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly on that front, and I think we'll talk about that more when we're talking about my my SADSEC libertarian ideas later on in this discussion. And so, yes, of course, there are things to be up in arms about if you're a small government conservative.
But a rule of law person who isn't particularly concerned with the size of government.
No, absolutely. But anyway, just the point I was making in my blog post, and that I think you've made along similar lines, was that the conservative movement seems to be dumbing down. That a movement that has always had its share of demagogues and crazies and wingnuts, nonetheless, prided itself in its move towards power in the 60s and 70s on being a movement of ideas. It was a movement that attracted brilliant intellectuals and Nobel Prize winning economists.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel that way anymore. So, and right. The case in point was having someone say something as completely uncontroversial as that Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity sometimes make sloppy arguments brings the house down upon you.
Yeah.
Suggests a movement that has moved in a very much in a populist direction, where it's rather than a movement that is powered by brilliant people with insightful but perhaps at the time unpopular ideas about how the world works. These days it seems to derive most of its energy from pandering to the to the untutored prejudices of a shrinking and increasingly reactionary base that is stirred up to high dudgeon by hucksters in talk radio and on Fox.
Look, your statement of the problem, I think, is not wrong. There's actually a rather hilarious example of that on Blogging Heads itself. One of the occasional participants in Blogging Heads is a young blogger named Matt Lewis. I don't know him, but he's apparently on Blogging Heads a couple times, you know, read people out of the movement. He read me out of the movement, said I wasn't a real conservative.
Yep.
So on the last Blogging Heads he appeared on, he was asked, well, what do you mean by a true conservative or a real conservative? And he said, well, I recommend people go look at the Wikipedia article on Russell Kirk.
On who?
Russell Kirk. He led out a definition.
Just the Wikipedia article.
If you look it up on Wikipedia, I wrote a piece of it. I said, okay, I've got a new definition of a true conservative. A true conservative is someone who has not read the books he thinks he admires.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the conservative mind actually isn't that challenging a book.
Right.
Look, it's got a lot of flaws. I'm not going to do a total defense of it, and I don't think it is a masterpiece of... I think it's a masterpiece of creative literature. I don't know that it's a masterpiece of scholarship exactly.
Yes.
I wrote an essay about this a dozen years ago, which I said, you know, Kirk reminded me of like those Eastern European nationalist historians who'd invent a history, who'd invent a country,
mm-hmm.
like Croatia. There had been some Slavs in this part of Yugoslavia. No, or in this part of the Balkans. No, they were Croats. They were a distinct
yes.
nation. They had a distinct history, and they were then created. And Kirk had a little bit of that function. But really, I mean, if you're going to, you ought to read it. I've just been reading another book, which I brought here as a prop. This is the big conservative bestseller, Mark Levin.
Yes, you've had your dust-ups with him.
I have my dust-ups with him, but the thing that is striking with... Now, Mark Levin is not an unintelligent person, I should be quickly said, and he is not an ignorant person. He actually, I mean, he's practiced law, he was chief of staff to Ed Meese. He knows quite a bit of law. But it's a remarkable book because it's completely isolated. From everything. I mean, Levin lives off in the Virginia countryside. He has almost no human contact. He doesn't even sit in the same studio with his producers. And that does bad things to the human mind. One of the things I'm not going to have it at my fingertips here, there's a passage I'm writing an essay about this, and I quote it, in which he says, "We conservatives know that liberty once lost is never recovered." Read that and think, that sounds rhetorical.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you're Czech.
Yes.
Or Hungarian,
yes.
Or Spanish, or Chilean,
or an airline,
or German, or unless you're in America,
yes.
Because lots, of, yeah, airlines that used to be regulated, gold coins that used to be
yes.
forbidden, you can now own them. In fact, if you think of, I mean, if you did a citation or you know, it offered a proof of your statement, you would rapidly discover, even for yourself, that this generalization was completely unfounded.
Right.
But we are moving into a world for conservatives of pure ideology, and where Levin in the book when he does offer proofs, they're not proofs, they're proof texts. That he will make a proposition and then he will for proof cite a passage from a speech by Barry Goldwater. And I admire Barry Goldwater in a lot of ways, but it's not a proof. Unless you're writing a biography of Barry Goldwater and want to demonstrate
yes.
Goldwater thought this or that, then a quotation
right.
is a proof.
No,
but if you want to make his point about the way a modern economy functions, it's not a proof.
Yeah. So if we generally agree that this phenomenon has happened, that mm-hmm. There's been a kind of degradation in intellectual standards and a sort of self-satisfied tendency to preach to the echo chamber rather than to engage the outside world, Do you have a theory as to what's going on?
Yeah, I do. I think what we're seeing is the completion of an intellectual process. Look, if you were to if we had this conversation in 1977 or 78, and were liberals, or if we were to listen to liberals talking, they would have many of the same things to say.
Yes.
That they had certain ideas about how to reform American society, ideas that had long pedigrees going back to before the First World War. They implemented quite a lot of them. In some ways, American society was the better for it. But the ideas were losing impetus. The human mind can only very imperfectly ever describe reality. And human solutions can only ever very imperfectly fix and correct or improve reality. And so, I don't know, you outrun the sources of your creativity. And that's a little bit of what's happened to conservatives. Now, I don't want to just do kicking around here because... I think we're going to rediscover a lot of these truths. I think we're going to see, and we're seeing with this hugely ambitious project that the Obama administration has, or projects, they've got lots of them, that they are they've got a couple of problems themselves. They are, one, they've got more policy ideas than they have theoretical knowledge on which to base those policy ideas. They have a sense of very limited time, so they're doing things very, very fast.
Yes.
And they are making a lot of mistakes. And I think we are going to be reminded, I just want to ask, how many people out there are there who think that what they're doing with the automobile sector is going to work? And how many people think that what they're doing, I mean, it's already beginning to be clear that what they're doing with the financial sector is not going to work, that there's all these the stress tests look like they weren't done right. I mean, how could you do it right? But and we're in danger of having this increasing interpenetration of the state and finance that is going to be, I think, very, the state setting salaries and things like that, that is going to make the American financial sector both more timid, less creative, and also exposes the government to the risk of corruption.
Yeah, I certainly, the hope for a conservative revival lies in liberal overreaching, and I see plenty of evidence of that. Once upon a time, I bought into the kind of stock conservative narrative that really the Goldwater campaign is what launched everything. It was this incredibly fruitful defeat that created a movement, and that movement then went marching on steadily upward and onward to culminating in Reagan's victory in 80. But the big missing piece in that puzzle is that the catastrophes and debacles of of the late 60s that resurrected conservatism from being a complete dead end political movement that had turned in one of the worst performances in a White House run in American history.
I think that Goldwater story is completely wrong, and I'll link it to an essay I read about this, but. Both conservatives and liberals have a stake in believing it. Conservatives have a stake in believing it because if you believe it, one, it looks like there was a real rise of the right. It wasn't just the opportunistic beneficiary of the collapse of liberalism. Second, the decision to support Goldwater in 64 looks less foolish than it otherwise would. And liberals like it because it suggests, aha, that the key to success is galvanizing your most committed supporters.
Yes.
And since there are even fewer committed liberals than there are committed conservatives, that's a pleasing narrative.
Right.
But the counterfactual history I point out to people when they get so celebratory about Goldwater is, just imagine you don't know what is going to happen in 1969, 70, and onwards. Here's the way you would tell history without knowledge of the future. In 1958, the Democrats win a big congressional victory because of the severe downturn of 58. They win the White House in 1960. I think Kennedy picks up. I think 60 is actually a year where they don't do well in Congress, but they pick up more seats in 62. That means that there is a big correction coming, a big Democratic congressional defeat coming.
Yes.
They've got too many seats. And indeed, it comes in 1966. It might have come in 1964 if the Republicans had at the top of the ticket a Scranton or a Rockefeller.
Mm-hmm.
They would have lost the White House because 64 was such a good economic year, but they would not have suffered big defeats in Congress. Instead, they did suffer terrible defeats in Congress, and in 65, 66, you have the most liberal Congress, maybe since the 30s, maybe
ever. Yes.
Now, you compare what happens in Congress in 1963 and 1964. That Congress does some liberal things. It passes some of the early elements of the war on poverty. I think it passes model cities. But it also passes what is called the Kennedy, but really should be called the Johnson tax cut. It walks a line between left and right. The Congress that is elected in 64 passes Medicaid, Medicare, immigration, the great immigration expansion, completely unchecked liberal hegemony. And yeah, it sets in motion.
Yeah, let me offer two cheers for the Immigration Act, but
I won't offer any. And by the way, it was an act that had consequences. If the proponents could have seen the consequences,
no, they had no idea what the consequences were.
Right,
that's for sure,
and they would have objected to them. But it unleashed, yes, the unraveling of liberalism, and. The mistakes made then did help to bring Ronald Reagan to power. But look, Ronald Reagan is dead, and Medicare isn't.
Right.
those changes were very permanent. And in retrospect, I think it might have been better to have had more seats in the House of Representatives in 1965 and 66, and maybe have George Bush had the Republican ticket in 1980 instead of Ronald Reagan. I'm not sure that would have been a worse trade.
So let me give you my two cents as to what I think's going on. This is our second blogging heads together. We did one some months ago, and I recall we talked about how the problems in conservatism, and our main focus then was how conservatism had been a victim of its successes, that it rose to power on fears of stagflation, fears of crime, and fears of Soviet expansionism, conquered stagflation, got a hold on, or at least started paying serious attention to crime, which later started getting better, we won the Cold War, and so many of its signature and most popular issues just went away because the good guys won. And I think that's part of the story. A lot of the reason for conservatism's current intellectual exhaustion is that it developed a set of issues about a set of problems, and those problems went away or got mitigated. But I think that in addition, conservatism is a victim of its unrecognized failures as well. First of all, and this helps to explain the kind of decline in intellectual firepower that we see on the right today. I would argue that a good deal of the of conservatism and intellectual firepower came from libertarians, and especially libertarian economists, who provided a lot of sort of intellectual and analytical rigor, both in terms of the critique of big government generally and in terms of the critique of big government economic policies in particular. And we've seen, I think, the libertarian voice within conservatism getting ever weaker, and the voice of kind of populist social conservatism getting ever stronger. And part of that, I think, is that the initial kind of theory of modern movement conservatism, the theory of fusionism, I believe, has turned out to be largely wrong. And that theory was the one encapsulated in the idea of libertarian means for conservative ends. So how do we create this strange, philosophically incoherent intellectual alliance between libertarians and social conservatives? We did it on the theory that they both had a common enemy of big government, and that ultimately a small government would, and a return to kind of pre-New Deal political economy would come to the rescue of traditional moral values and social norms that had been under assault by liberal big government. As it turned out, though, we had a lot of libertarian victories on the economic front in the 70s and 80s. We have a much more market-oriented entrepreneurial economic system than we used to. And it really didn't do squat for reviving traditional, that is, pre-60s social norms, values, and beliefs. Instead, the country has gotten ever richer, more affluent, more bobo, and more socially liberal.
That's can I stop you there? Because what you've said is so rich. There are so many things to leap off, and if you keep going, it's going to be like a strudel with apples, but also
I'll pause.
Raisins. No, because those are this is the core thesis of the Lindsay Life. It's the thesis set out in your book about affluence, and it's a series of very powerful ideas there. And let me just can I add some comments to some of them. First, let me start at the back end. I don't know that I think you overstate the degree to which affluence has unleashed social liberalism. If you look at the top third of American society, I think you see a much more conservative place, socially conservative, than you did when we were young. The divorce rate, for example, for people with college degrees has come down very sharply. I lay out the numbers in my book recently. I mean, that basically a college-educated woman who got married in 1992 was a lot less likely to get divorced after 15 years than a college-educated woman who got married in 1973. So that, and it's just our, people have, how many of the people have three children? How many of the people have You know, when I was a kid, my parents used to joke there was a George Segal movie called The Last Married Couple in America. They lived in Canada, but they applied the joke to themselves. Well, I mean, most, you know, divorce is a comparatively rare thing in the circles in which you and I move. And this is probably an illusion, an anecdotal illusion, there seem to be more at-home mothers. I mean, the upper third seems to have had a kind of stabilization of life.
I agree completely.
And one of the elements of social conservatism is the work ethic. And boy, you know, you can't. I was at a conference in the Middle East a couple of years ago where somebody made some comment about how decadent the West was. And my response was, well, when I was in the gym at 6:30 in the morning, the only people I saw there were Westerners.
Yes.
Because I know none of the other attendees at this conference in the hotel gym. I mean, so this is a highly disciplined, more focused. Again, we're talking about the upper third. So I think that is something that there's a risk of overstating your thesis. It's true at the bottom third. I think you are right. I mean, it's still the 1970s there. I think.
No, but let me back up and say, I agree with what you just said, but I've got a different spin on it. But in terms of socially liberal attitudes about sex roles, you know, sexuality, the role of religion in public life, the character of American national identity, I think we've gotten a lot more liberal, and that upper third of the American income distribution is considerably more liberal on those issues
I wonder about that. I mean,
than the bottom third. So yes, on the core middle class values of work ethic and nuclear family, we have had a you know, a resurgence in those core middle class norms at the in the American elite or the top third, and that's the Bobo phenomenon, right? It's bourgeois lifestyle mixed with bohemian culture and sort of cosmological and
beliefs. I know. I would say it's capital B, capital O, small b, small o. But I just think that there's a real overstatement, and I think that the baby boomers, I think you can see there's much more public display of religiosity. And if you compare, and this is something I did in my book on the 70s, the 50s are the golden age of church membership. People came back from World War II, they were joiners, they wanted stability in their lives after the horrible experiences they'd had, and they joined churches. But public religiosity in the 50s was very subdued. The baby boomers are less membership-oriented, but they are much more expressive. They're much more emotional. And that applies both to conservative and liberal baby boomers, and they bring that outspokenness and that public expressiveness to their religiosity. And I don't know, so I want to be careful.
Right, but of course...
That can all be overstated.
Yeah, so, there's been a huge increase from the 60s to the 70s, and then another pretty big increase from the late 90s to now in no religious affiliation at all.
Yes.
And that's concentrated in...
I think that's right.
That's concentrated in the groups of people that have the lowest crime rates, lowest divorce rates, lowest illegitimacy rates. And here, let me just... That segues, I think, into what I think is the second intellectual error of conservatism, which was a confusion of baby and bathwater. Yes, core middle-class values of work ethic and family life were under assault by a far-left fringe and radical rebellion against sort of everything that was traditional in American life during the 60s and 70s, and we've seen, in that sense, a conservative revival. Most strongly in the more well-to-do sections of American society, but the conservative idea was based on the premise that those core middle-class values were part and parcel of a much bigger worldview anchored in traditional religious beliefs, anchored in traditional sex roles, anchored for a while in traditional racial arrangements, and that all turned out to be wrong. So the idea was that if we give up on old-time religion, if we give up on women in the kitchen, if we give up on racial segregation, if we give up on the homosexual closet, then the world's going to come to an end, and civilization as we know it's going to come crashing down around our ears. And during the 60s and 70s and 80s, that looked like a pretty plausible case. But then the 90s came, and we saw, without any real overturning of the 60s social revolutions, or 60s post-60s belief structures, we saw, huge progress in all of these social indicators: crime, divorce, illegitimacy, welfare dependency, etc. And indeed, the places where things look best are, blue state America, blue state New England, which is the place where kind of movement conservatism, it is at its absolute weakest, is nonetheless the place where the sort of goals of movement conservatism have been most successfully realized.
On the other hand, Southern and Northern California aren't looking so healthy these days. A huge increase in gang violence, and especially in places like Oakland. So, but let me take that on and say, now I want to do a more radical, rather than, I think we've stated our disagreements yep. on this point. Let me now offer a more radical challenge to what you were saying. And one of the ways that I would say my thinking, your libertarianism has devoured much of your conservatism.
Yes.
I would say in my case, what has been happening is my lowercase r republicanism has been challenging my conservatism. And let me explain what I mean by that. Let me give you a counter narrative to what happened. It seems to me what happened. I agree with you about the success of these economic ideas largely derived from the libertarians. I think you have to give some credit to the social ideas largely derived from neoconservative thinkers like James Q. Wilson,
I agree.
Crime, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the people with the critiques of welfare, that the successful critique of the welfare programs came not from, Milton Friedman's idea of a negative income tax turns out to be a really bad idea, and the idea of providing assistance through non-cash means, but otherwise requiring people to work and not leaving it up to the individual option whether you work or not, that which was the neoconservative
yes.
view, that turned out to be the right answer,
yep.
the better answer.
A better answer, for sure.
Okay, so here's let me suggest what happened. When we unleashed the creativity and dynamism of the American economy, we did an unbelievable thing. It really worked. We'd raised the growth rate, the overall growth rate, by a point. We raised labor productivity in particular by a point and a half. Doesn't sound like much, but that has tremendous impact. And America is a more, as we both agree, more creative, more entrepreneurial. And the people who bring a lot to the economic party have been huge winners. They are participating in it, because it's not just what happened here at home, it's the global explosion. They're participating that there's suddenly a global market for what they have to sell. I just blanked on the guy's name. I was looking up recently the career of one of the most successful architects of the 1950s, the guy who designed the Seagram Building. I think, as far as I can tell, he built only one building outside the United
mm-hmm.
States, the Hilton Hotel in Istanbul. Okay, now you look at today's celebrity architects. They sell to the world,
yes.
and they are multi-millionaires.
Right.
Frank Gehry or Norman Stone, is that his name, the guy who designed the Jerkin in London? These guys become centimillionaires
yes.
because of their global market. If you own an asset in the United States, I wrote a piece about this a little while ago, that when the Chrysler Building was sold half a century ago, it was sold to a guy who lived five blocks away in the Waldorf Astoria. And there's now a worldwide market for assets. So if you own an asset in the United States, you have many more customers. So there are huge returns to the skills and assets of the top people in American economic life. Meanwhile, the less skilled are competing with the whole world, and both through immigration and also through, which I'm more skeptical of than you, but also inevitably through trade, which is, I think we both are in favor of, but it has consequences for the people who are competing with global labor rather than sellers to global markets. So we get a much more unequal society. And this, I think, is a big part of what is going on in our internal debates about conservatism and liberalism. I mean, the people who responded to Sarah Palin, they were expressing something real. When they were going on about elitism and feeling looked down upon, that's a mood that is really strong in sort of the white middle of American society. And I think that is a little bit that conservatism kept some of its promises, and I think it kept, I would argue, contrary to you, that it did keep its promise that a more dynamic society would restabilize some elements of social life, but it also put economic pressures on the middle of American society, and especially the white middle that had much higher expectations of what they were due than the non-white middle. And we're coping a little bit with that, and conservatism is reflecting some of that. I mean, I am just struck again and again and again how much of talk radio, and I've been listening to a lot more of it recently, expresses feelings of resentment.
Yes.
And not just fear of people below them, which you would hear a lot if you listen to Bob Grant in the 1970s, but resentment of people they think are above them, who regard themselves as smarter, who are more well-educated, who are going to all of these fabled cocktail parties in Georgetown that we're always, that, you know, we're supposed to believe that the American elite goes to. That's part of the story too, and my lowercase republicanism makes me think that when, as I'm developing my ideas, I mean, look, I'm no egalitarian, God knows, but we need to take on board the idea that there are maybe levels of inequality that threaten some things that conservatives care about too.
Yeah, I have a slightly different take. I think what you're talking about, the general phenomenon of the rise in inequality, is a very important part of the. Of the story of ideological developments on both the left and the right in this country, and I've written some on the question of inequality. I did a Cato paper that then was excerpted in Reason magazine recently about why what policies and social norms have changed that have helped to produce more income inequality. This is basically a debunking of Paul Krugman's very simplistic ideological morality tale that big bad conservatives made us more unequal. I dubbed that nostalgianomics and wrote this piece about that. I also did something for The New Republic that on the kind of cultural basis of increasing inequality, and that's what I want to focus on. So yes, absolutely, we have a more globalized world, a more competitive world, and therefore a much more complicated world than we had in the 50s and 60s. And what that means is it has created incentives for what economists bloodlessly call investment in human capital, that is, increases in education and job skills. And those who respond to those incentives have profited enormously. Those who have been unable to respond to those incentives have fallen behind. So what we have seen since the late 1970s is a huge increase in the wage premium that goes to college graduates relative to high school graduates. After the huge run-up in college grads in the 60s and 70s, there was all this talk about the overeducated American, and there wasn't any point in going to college anymore. And then we saw this huge run-up in the college premium, an even bigger run-up in the graduate degree premium. And what does that mean? It means that the market has been pushing people in a completely salutary direction, rather than the old image of Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times, where the fate of most people is just to turn one bolt forever on an assembly line. What the market has been telling people is, for God's sake, get smarter, get more skills. We need your brains, not your brawn. And it's told them that by ramping up the price of the return on acquiring those skills. But that premium has stayed in place and has even gotten bigger, which means that people aren't responding to that market incentive by increasing their skills. In fact, college graduation rate has more or less plateaued in the late 70s, early 80s, and hasn't really grown very much since then. The high school graduation rate plateaued in the late 60s and may have even gone down a little bit since then.
By the way, Brink, this is the origin of our disagreement over whether immigration policies, or the current ones, are right or wrong.
Yes.
That I think immigration is a huge part of this story. Basically, we've had, close to 40 million migrants to the United States since 1970.
Yep.
Enormously, disproportionately unskilled.
Yes.
And contrary to romantic hopes, they are turning out, they're staying that way. We have very high out-of-wedlock birth rates among Mexican-Americans, who are the single largest group of the new migrants. Very low high school completion rates, below African-Americans, I think. I mean, Jay Green at Manhattan Institute makes the point that the statistic, that most statistics lump together people who get a high school equivalency diploma later,
yes.
So people who graduate on time. But in fact, there's a huge difference in life outcomes for people who graduate on time and people who do it later.
Yeah, James Heckman has made that point.
Okay, so and so in terms of completing high school within 4 years, that among Mexican Americans, and that's among Hispanics general, not just recent immigrants, it's below African Americans, and that's really scary.
Let me just check you there. It's hard to tease out what's going on because we keep having these floods of brand new, completely unskilled immigrants that sort of complicate what's going on in Hispanic America. I think the evidence is pretty good that overall assimilation is working pretty well. It's not working as well
but
as
skill
I would.
Skill accumulation is not. And yes, they're learning English for sure, and they're thinking of themselves as American. But are they accumulating the skills? And what is then the overall shape of the country?
Yeah, I think there's the fear of immigration restrictionists that just sort of culturally Hispanics are a nation apart. And I think on that front, assimilation is working fine.
Yes, I would agree.
And that's not a problem. On the human capital front, I agree that it looks like on educational attainment, Hispanics are not proceeding from generation to generation in the way you would want to. But that's a problem, of course, for African Americans, and it's a problem for lots of working class white Americans as well.
Right.
This is the resentment you're hearing on talk radio isn't Hispanics and blacks. It's
right.
It's non college educated whites.
And when we talk about skills, I spent a few days in the Detroit and Windsor, Ontario area recently, where a place I hadn't been since I was the center city, a place I haven't been since I was a teenager and saw the Red Wings play the Toronto Maple Leafs. And what is striking when you go there is that when we talk about skills, we're not just talking about math and science and things like that. We're talking about interpersonal skills.
Yes.
There's a big hotel, there's the casinos, there's a hotel industry. I was talking to a manager of one of the major hotels there. He can't get people to be polite. it sounds kind of an effete problem,
yes.
Right? But I mean, you take people who come from three generations of unionized manual labor who emphasize, a kind of hostility. There's a lot of hostility between classes, between labor and management. And you say, okay, now we need you to work on the desk at the hotel and check in clients. And actually, you can make as much money doing that as your father ever made on the line, only you have to be nice to people. And people find that very difficult to do.
Here again, I'm afraid your social conservatism is getting in the way of progress, because what we have been seeing is that
Social conservatism.
Social conservatism. not mine, that's for sure. And that is, we've seen the kind of declining prospects for blue collar man. Right, those jobs are going away, and if there are opportunities exist. More and more are ones in the service sector, and they depend upon a suite of personality traits and kind of non-cognitive skills, like getting along with people, being nice, being empathetic, being a good team player, that have nothing to do with traditional working class definitions of male identity. And so we've seen women doing a lot better on the income inequality front than we've seen men, and a chunk of that, I agree, is immigration. That makes our inequality stats look worse, even as those people are becoming much less unequal than they were before, but it makes our national stats look worse. But it's also happening on the white male front, as folks who are kind of stuck in traditional attitudes about what it means to be a man are being left behind by the way the world is.
This is a good segue to something we should take then our last 10 minutes to talk about, which is the modem in Europe.
Yes.
Because we're going to spend $100 billion trying to save those jobs in the Detroit area,
right.
And probably I think there'll be some additional hidden costs because I think there'll be a lot of pressure on banks in which the government has a role to be very supportive of manufacturing. And the massive subsidies that are going through the stimulus bill toward various kinds of state and local infrastructure projects. A lot of them are a disguised subsidy to those kinds of industries. And what we are seeing is that the thing that you were so hopeful about 2 years ago, which is that it was going to be a fusion of Bob Rubin's economics with a less ambitious foreign policy, with social liberalism, that would be the future. That's turning out not to be the future as far as the leaders of the Democratic Party are concerned.
No, it's
they seem to have unlearned everything they've learned since 1994.
I full-throatedly decry the general thrust of economic policymaking in the Obama administration. I think the stimulus bill is a misbegotten waste of money, and I think worst of all, is the handling of the automobile situation, in which you have just a trashing of the rule of law in a way that I think has profoundly disturbing implications. So very disappointed in all of that. I fully expected to disagree with the Obama administration on just about all economic policies. I ended up voting for Obama on a very sort of pre-ideological basis, which is believing in a fundamental principle of democratic accountability, and that as a general matter, being in power corrupts you, and there needs to be an alternation in power, and both sides get something right some of the time, and that it was the Republicans' time to go, and I still believe that, and I think the way the Republican Party has been acting out of power demonstrates that they have no business being anywhere near power.
Maybe it demonstrates you have no business being out of power. We're bad at being out of power.
So they messed up, and they deserved to be thrashed for it, and they got thrashed. Now we've got this administration, and I think, as you've mentioned earlier in this discussion, there's a number of sort of tar pits that they've wandered into and are going to get caught in, and a number of bad mistakes they've made that are going to be with us for some time, and that indeed will likely create political opportunities in the future for Republicans and conservatives. All that said, does that mean that my whole libertarian shtick was a bad idea? I don't think so, because I never really envisioned this as a near-term political strategy. The idea of an alliance between libertarians and liberals is not a very good political strategy idea, because there just aren't that many self-identified libertarians. They're not fit alliance partners for anybody in a vote-counting political consultant kind of way. What I had in mind was the intellectual exhaustion of conservatism, and which had created a moment in which libertarians could think again about where they stand, and I came to the conclusion, and I hold that conclusion more firmly now than before, that the principles I believe in, and that I know you share at least some of them, the principles of limited government and free markets, those principles I know we share, I believe that those principles are best expressed, and indeed can only be properly expressed, in the language of liberalism. They are liberal ideas. They have a liberal heritage. The language of individual rights, autonomy, free choice is the language in which they ought to be expressed. Okay. Fundamentally, at bottom, if conservatism has a philosophy, it is about kind of traditional notions of authority and hierarchy, and I don't think that's the good fit for these ideas. So my hope someday is to create within liberalism a space for people who believe like me, and my hope is that the Obama administration's overreaching is going to make that easier to do.
Okay, but then you feed that through the American political system. Do you think let's take up a genuine practical problem. Chicago needs a new airport. O'Hare is overcrowded. What are we going to do about that? And the libertarian instinct is to say, well, let's create some kind of way, maybe a kind of an independent corporation, the government can be involved in it somehow, which will accumulate land and buy in the most efficient way and, you know, do bidding, and everything would be done with an idea of cost effectiveness. Now, which political party is going to be more receptive to that idea. Is it ever? I mean, we know that because it's happening right now. That we are seeing you run that concept through the Democratic Party, through the Daily Machine in Chicago, and what you get is a political system that evaluates this concept with an eye to how do we create the maximum number of unionized jobs beholden to the political authorities, and that's the way the Democratic Party works. I mean, it is not going to be.
Yeah, it is certainly.
It is not going to be a receptive place.
It is certainly the way it is working. We are in the process of beholding a great shrinkage in the number of private sector union jobs, Obama's efforts notwithstanding. But the idea that parties have fixed, unalterable political programs, I think, is just completely ahistorical. They flipped all over the place. If the Republican Party used to be able to count on anything, it was the party of big business and finance. And yet now, you know, Wall Street and big business, i.e. Silicon Valley, are Democratic Party bastions. So I think the old country club Republicans who were economically conservative but socially liberal flee Republicans because they just can't stand the dumbing down of the party and the boisterous, brutish kind of chest-thumping nationalism, xenophobia, and homophobia that you hear out of talk radio. As they run away from Republicans and enter the Democratic Party, they're not going to leave all of their economic ideas behind them, and my hope is that they can moderate what's going on in the anti-market and machine politics constituencies of the Democratic Party.
But that's a pure hope. Right? Because if I were to ask you to cite one example since January 2009, where the Obama administration has done anything that reflects your hopes, can you do it?
I didn't say that this was going to play out now. I think there was two steps to this cockeyed idea working in practice. First, conservatism had to completely discredit itself and chase libertarians and libertarianish people away from it. Okay, that step, check that box. The second step is big government machine politics liberalism had to completely discredit itself so that people who fled conservatism didn't flee into status quo liberalism. My hope is that that process is underway right now. What's your hope? People like you who are saying the Republican Party needs to, move past fighting the 60s are just getting beaten up and treated as heretics. So yeah. We're both forlorn wilderness dwellers at the current time.
I'm not too forlorn.
No, me neither.
But let me just first one comment on what you just said. The idea that you're going to beat machine politics with better ideas. The people who nobody supports machine politics because they think it's a good idea. That's not the source of its power. It's money for me. Okay, here's my not only hope but my prediction for the Republican Party and for conservatives. We are going to go through a very reactionary phase. We are going to be very loud and very dumb, and we're going to be that way for some time. But what the Obama administration is trying to do is not going to work. The auto industry is just a huge hostage to fortune. I think the financial and spending decisions will take longer to have their consequences. And
I think we're also going to be saddled with high unemployment for a long time, and it's going to make the stimulus idea look like a failure.
Right. Even if there was some truth to this, even if a better designed stimulus could have had,
yeah, but this one was not well designed.
This was because of machine. It was about driven by machine politics, not by anyway. Okay, you got it. We agree. We are going to see a revival of free market thinking in a more modest form. And a lot of the libertarian hopes that flourished in the 70s, where we thought, when we take the tax rate from 70 to 50, and then from 50 to 28, and then from 28 to nothing, we're going to be chastened by that. But that we've seen that the strength of machine politics and collectivist economics is strong enough that the party lines are going to be divided to a great extent still on more free market, less free market areas. And the things that have damaged the Republican Party are going to fall away. Attractive politicians are going to come to the fore. Talk radio, I think talk radio is much likelier to burn itself out than the machine politics are. And we're going to see some. By the way, I am very suspicious of the numbers that are attributed to talk radio, and I think we're going to see those numbers continue to decline as the population ages and as the audience for that kind of resentment becomes older and poorer and more rural. I think we're going to see a kind of we're going to see what something similar to what happened in Britain, something similar to what happened in Canada, similar to what's happened even in France, which is people of all kinds of points of view, of different social views, rallying to a free market, more free market alternative. And we're going to see some interesting new leadership taking place at the state level. Governor Huntsman, who was one of the most promising people I thought, has taken himself out of the cycle for 2012. Yep. But ambassadorships don't last forever.
Yeah, so first of all, I don't give a hoot about parties. So if a rediscovery of libertarian ideas occurs in the Republican Party, that's fine by me. So I, the way I see it, even though we're standing on opposite sides of the ideological divide these days, we ought to have sympathies with each other. That is, I certainly would like to see a more libertarian, free market friendly Republican Party. I'm sure you would like to see a more libertarian, free market friendly Democratic Party. And so we can view each other's efforts as a hedge.
As a hedge. All right. Well, on that note,
all right.
And we know how well hedgers are doing these
well,
days.
It's good in theory. all right. Nice talking to you. I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Bye.
All right.
Bye.